Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the UBS conference call on the French court's judgment in a cross-border matter. I'm Iruna, the Chorus Call operator. The conference must not be recorded for publication or broadcast. At this time, it's my pleasure to hand over to Martin Osinga, UBS Investor Relations. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. We will start with a few remarks by our Group CEO, Sergio Ermotti. You will then hear Markus Diethelm, our Group General Counsel, who is in Paris with our External Counsel, Denis Schemla. After that, we'll have a Q&A. I should now draw your attention to our cautionary statement regarding forward-looking statements in the media release we published on the matter in question yesterday. With that, I'll hand over to Sergio.
Thank you very much, Martin, and good morning, everyone. We set up this call to help you understand our view on the legal aspects of this matter, and this is the focus of the call. But before that, I want to make some brief comments in respect of the matters. In respect of resolving all these litigation matters, as we said many times in the past, our aim is always to act in the best interest of shareholders, taking into consideration both financial and reputational aspects. As you know, over the last few years, we resolved many legacy matters. We have not shied away from settling matters when reasonable, but we can't do that at any financial price, particularly when this is not supported by facts. Specifically, in this case, we consistently contested any criminal wrongdoing, and we continue to do so. On the actions in questions, we have followed and respected all proper regulations, Swiss, French, and European. And we strongly disagree with the verdict. We prepared ourselves very seriously with both internal and external legal counsel at the most senior levels. The notion that has been circulating that we would gamble on this matter is totally inappropriate and not a notion that we would even have entertained. We do not gamble with our shareholders' capital. Likewise, any speculation about for which amount a settlement was possible is inappropriate and not correct. One of the advantages of having a strong capital and liquidity position is that we can withstand and afford taking such a stance on resolving matters. Of course, we are very disappointed by the verdict, and you will hear from Markus how we prepare to further defend ourselves. Now, in respect of the financial impact of the verdict, it's still too early to give any guidance about potential changes in the legal provisions. The assessment is not a decision we can complete within a couple of days. We will have to go through a number of steps that include a more in-depth legal analysis of the verdict in order to assess any potential accounting implications. All this will then have to go through the governance process of the bank. We expect to complete this by the publication of our 2018 annual report. I understand some of you also have questions on capital returns. First of all, there is no intention to deviate from our proposed 2018 dividend of 70 Rappen per share. In respect of the outlook for our capital returns beyond the financial year 2018, we remain committed to our policy. We are still targeting a mid to high single-digit percentage growth in our dividend per share each year. And we are still aiming to return excess capital mainly through buybacks. Of course, as we always said, we need to consider our business outlook, including the impact of any idiosyncratic events like this one. In this respect, in the event of a very adverse scenario, our priority would always be to protect the previous year's dividend. You can expect an update on our plans latest by April when we publish our first quarter results. With that, I'd like to hand it over to Markus in Paris.
Thank you, Sergio, and good morning, everyone. As you well know, on Wednesday, the first instance court in Paris has delivered an adverse judgment in the case against UBS AG and UBS France and several employees. Throughout the process, we have consistently contested, as Sergio said, any criminal wrongdoing in this case, and we continue to do so. On the actions in questions, we have followed and respected all the proper regulations, Swiss, French, and European, and we strongly disagree with the verdict. We have launched an appeal on the way out of court on Wednesday. Today, there are several important points of the case that I would like you to focus on. First, the prosecution has failed to produce any convincing evidence against UBS during the trial. Second, given the size of the fine and the very high profile nature of the case, the judgment is very thin. Third, although we believe no fine is warranted, because we believe that no criminal wrongdoing occurred, the court has made errors in setting the amounts that grabbed the media headlines. On the first point, we continue to believe the prosecution's accusations were not backed by any concrete or credible evidence. Facts and statements in our favor were entirely ignored by the court. For example, from UBS clients interviewed during the investigations that have all said that they've never met with a UBS client advisor in France. Further, we were also denied access to the tax authorities' regularization files on the grounds of equal access to information. An obviously incorrect ruling, as the French state oversees both prosecution and the tax authorities, and they enjoyed full access to the documents in question. The court ruling itself is, as I said before, thin. On the entire 38 pages referring to the merits of the case, there is no in-depth response to UBS's argumentation and evidence, just a mere repetition of prosecution's documents and claims. I invite everyone to read the judgment that is available. The verdict relies on an article of the French tax code, for instance, that was not even in effect during the period covered by the charges, and which refers to very different kinds of taxes than those covered by the charges. On the last point, we strongly contest any liability in this case, but even if calculating the fine, the court has made serious mistakes. Although it correctly argues the fine should be based on the proceeds of tax evasions, i.e. the non-pay tax, it then goes on to set it based on the amounts of total assets of 3.7 billion that have been declared. In the document itself, they refer to the unpaid tax of an amount of 620 million, which includes taxes that are not even in question here. So there is not a shred of substantiation justifying the civil damages of 800 million, as well as the support of the 3.7 billion that the court followed the prosecution on. To summarize, we think the proceedings to date failed to address our argumentation and evidence proving our innocence in this matter. We expect the appeals process will correct these mistakes. And why do we expect that these mistakes are being corrected? The Court of Appeals operates under the strict control of the Supreme Court, the French Cour de Cassation. A failure to respond to our argument would be a reason for denial or acquittal. I quickly pass over to Denis Schemla of Allen & Overy, who's our lead external counsel, to give any additional comments before we'll open for questions.
Thank you, Marcus. Just can only confirm what Marcus told you. Just to briefly summarize the position, this was a case which was based on the testimonies of 4 to 5 former employees. Those testimonies were not backed by any other evidence, no concrete evidence, no hard evidence, no documents, just the statements made by these people. These people were not even called at trial as witnesses by the prosecution. There were no witnesses for the prosecution at trial. And the court basically took the view it took by simply relying on the written arguments made by the prosecutors prior to the trial and prior to the defense filed by UBS, and made no reference at all to our arguments. This is a very unusual situation. This is a very unusual judgment in that respect. We have filed an appeal to the Court of Appeals, and we expect to get a different treatment before the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals is a different court. It is made up of senior judges, much more experienced than the judges we were before. It is also a completely different environment. The first instance court we were before was a court where the prosecutors, the investigating judges, and the trying judges, the trial judges, were all colleagues. They all belong to the same court. Prosecutors in France are attached to a court. The Court of Appeals is a different court with different prosecutors and different judges, so completely removed from the first instance court, and that gives them greater independence and greater ability to review the findings of the first instance court. Before the Court of Appeals, we have the right to get a second trial, both on facts and law, a new trial, afresh. Timing is approximately between now and the judgment in the Court of Appeals, about 2 years, and we get a chance to lay out our defense again, file additional evidence if we wish, taking account of the first instance decision in order to rectify some of the findings. As Mark has said, the Court of Appeals, contrary to the first instance court, is under a legal obligation to precisely respond to our arguments, because if it fails to do so, the Supreme Court above may overturn the decision for failure to address or respond to arguments raised by the defense. So I'm confident that the appeals process will be a better process and that we can get to a substantially different result before the Court of Appeals.
Martin, we'll open for questions.
We can open for questions.
The first question comes from Stefan Starmann, Autonomous Research. Please go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for arranging the call. I have two questions, please, rather legal questions. The first one is about statutes of limitations for cases maybe in other countries. I don't know if you can generally comment on that, but I would be quite curious how you think about potential similar cases in other countries, in particular in Europe, and whether you see the chance that at some point the statute of limitations might protect you from these kind of potential claims. The second question is, you have settled with various authorities similar cases in the past, for instance, with Germany a couple of years back. Do you think that these kind of settlements provide you with enough shield to settle these cases for good? Or is it possible that new facts come to light, new angles could be prosecuted, and that you may face additional claims in countries where you have already settled?
Thank you. So let me take that question in reverse. As far as the settlements are concerned, in Germany, there's a rule that if you settle with one of the states, it applies to all the states in Germany, and it covers all the behavior that we settled for, which has been described in a very broad fashion. You can imagine that we do not expect, subsequently to the closure of that settlement, that any wrongdoing has occurred in the general environment that the bank has consistently fostered and implemented, both on the compliance and on the control side, in addition to the situation for clients. Let's not forget that the time in 2004, which is when the investigation period began here, was a very different time to recent times, where it became very clear that automatic information exchange will become standard and indeed now is fully in place. So I do not expect any of the settlements that we've concluded to be reopened. On your question of statute of limitations in France, that's a three-year period for fraud. And in that sense, it helps that we consistently, in the interest of shareholders, fight the case where we are convinced that we're not guilty. Obviously, our statute of limitations in France is not an issue because we have been in this proceeding. But as far as other countries are concerned, that have not opened investigations, it clearly helps because the world has changed, behavior of individual taxpayers has changed, and in this French matter, as you well noted, there is no mentioning of any individual prosecution. The French tax authorities has never gone against individuals in any significant fashion. So I believe our consistency and our dedication and perseverance in addressing this in front of legal courts is the right one.
Thank you very much.
The next question from the phone comes from Andrew Stimpson, Bank of America. Please go ahead.
Thank you, everyone. So both of my questions probably directed towards Sergio here. So firstly, I just want to know what, if anything, FINMA has made of this yet, please. I appreciate you're convinced on your side of the case, but clearly if you're a regulator, you have to plan for the worst. And when similar kinds of things have happened before, we've seen operational risk-weighted asset requirements go up. Is that something that you think could be a consequence of the decision from the French courts? And then secondly, is there any feedback so far? I know it's very early, but from clients so far, and is there any reason we should expect that the negative headlines could start to interfere with inflows? Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. As I mentioned before, so first of all, we are in constant dialogue with all regulators globally, and particularly with our main regulator, FINMA. And you know, we first need to complete the assessment of the judgment, and in that sense, as soon as we complete that process, we will need to understand the accounting implication and if there is any additional implication. So that's the reason I'm saying that the first one can probably be addressed by the publication of the annual report and latest by our Q1 results. We will also be able to give more clarity about any further regulatory consequences, but you have to assume that, of course, we are very on top and very in constant dialogue with our regulators. In respect of clients, I have to say that one of the most important elements of our communication and our in respect of this verdict was also to make it very clear to not only to you as a our shareholders or stakeholders, but also to our clients and our employees and to the wider public to make them aware about the facts. And in that sense, I have to say that the reaction of clients and employees has been very good, very supportive. I see absolutely no sign of people being concerned across the board. And actually, I have to say that there is a high degree of support for our stance and our position. So absolutely no impact on business.
Okay, thank you.
The next question comes from Kian Abu Hussein with JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Yes, thanks for taking my questions. The first question is regarding the process. You mentioned the legal appeals court. I wanted to see, as I understand it, are there two appeals that you can do? And in case you lose those, can you take this case to the EU court, or are there as any other legal matters that you can take forward following to the two appeals, potentially? And if you can give me a time frame around, you mentioned the first appeal, 2 years. What about the second? How long would that take? And also if you can take it even further out in terms of taking legal action. The second question is regarding, you mentioned regularization, and I would like to understand, will you get the information on regularization filing in the appeal? Do you get any additional factual information, or is the information that you have all you get at this point?
Let me tee it up, and then Denis Schemmler will give you the detail on the procedure. As far as the regularization file is concerned, it is of course very important because this is a criminal matter, and the burden of proof is with the prosecution and with the court that the crime exists. We have the right in our defense to say that that is not so. So, for instance, as you know, we're only charged here for three types of taxes. That's income tax, wealth tax,
and corporate tax,
but not inheritance tax. The report itself says that a vast majority of the regularized French taxpayers have owed inheritance tax. So we have, we will try again to make that point and get access to that file. The French state has not given us, and that would be one of the arguments on appeal, question of law, whether our rights to defend ourselves have not been observed. I'd pass it over to Denis Schemmler to give you the details on timing of the appeals procedure, including the European Court of Human Rights.
So there's the first appeal to the Court of Appeals, as you said, which takes up to 2 years. Further to that, there is a second appeal to the Supreme Court, which is an automatic right of appeal, but only on points of law, due process, and procedure, and that takes another 2 years, approximately. Following the last decision of the Supreme Court, there is always the possibility to petition the European Commission, the European Court on Human Rights, for a violation of provisions of the Convention, the European Convention on Human Rights, rights to a fair trial, predominantly. That takes, again, in my experience, another 2 to 3 years.
And may I just ask court, the EU court, is that something that you would consider, and is that in your decision process, or you apply, they make a decision, is this case is actually going to be listened to?
I think it's important to, as we always do, is to evaluate the arguments that have been decided or the decisions that have been made by the court. We could not, for instance, now ask the European Court of Human Rights on a violation of the convention before we exhaust the French process, and we'll take that up as we learn more about it. As you know, on the amount of the bail, we did go to the European Court of Human Rights because we said, as you've all seen, that this has been widely publicized in the French press, and we were presumed guilty before we were able to argue our innocence. But the European Court of Human Rights said that this is not the time to look at it because the prejudice has actually not occurred yet. So one has to be very careful as to what you appeal to the European Court of Human Rights, and we can only make that decision once we're there.
And as far as the EU courts are concerned, you can only move to the EU courts if there's a point of EU law involved. At this stage, we haven't identified any relevant points of EU law. This is something we'll take another look at in light of the once we've fully analyzed the first instance decision.
Thank you very much.
The next question comes from Andrew Coombs with Citigroup. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning, and I'll just echo my thanks for hosting this call. I fully appreciate your comments that you will give an update with the annual report from an accounting perspective, but I just did want to touch on some of the points you made. I think under IAS 37, you have to book a provision should the payment be considered probable and can be estimated reliably. There's obviously a hard number out there, so from an estimated reliably standpoint, one would assume that that threshold is met. So it becomes a subjective decision to some extent on the probable element, I would assume. So I'd be interested to better understand. You said that you are doing an internal assessment of that. I'd be interested to better understand exactly what you need to assess, and then the role of the external auditor in the process as well, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Ian. I guess your comprehensive questions add already three quarters of the answer. So we are going through the process. We make our own assessment. We have the governance, including the audit committee and the board of directors, overseeing any decision. We have the auditors. We have regulators. So it's a comprehensive process that, as I mentioned, will take some time. And I'm pretty confident that we will come to the right conclusion on what is appropriate and not, also based on the further analysis we need to do on the verdict. So latest by then, we will be able to give you a more precise answer to the question.
Okay, and just a follow-up, but from a legal side, and I probably know the answer ahead of time on this, but does this court case make you consider and change your approach to any of the other legal matters that are outstanding where you've also decided to go through a court process?
No, I think, well, you know, we don't have so many other legal matters where we have decided to take accept or take a proactive legal actions to fight any situation. And as I mentioned in my opening remarks, our attitude was always to basically be realistic where there was any sign of any light gray. We would need to accept a pragmatic solution despite any legal angle we may or may not have. When things are pretty straightforward, like the case in France, the situation is completely different. So you have to really understand that the French situation is quite unique. So we will continue to use very pragmatic and realistic approach and responsible approach in respect on how we look at these matters vis-a-vis the governments or regulators, but also vis-a-vis our shareholders. And when we decide to take a different angle is because we believe, as a bank, that we have also a fiduciary duty in respect of making sure that both our financial interests, but also very importantly, our reputation is not affected. And although it looks like there is an element in which some principles are also very important that goes beyond some financial implications. And here, is really a matter of facts to defend also our reputation and the reputation of our people, that our employees, our colleagues that are exposed to this kind of situations.
Thank you very much.
The next question comes from Andrew Lim with Societe Generale. Please go ahead, sir.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my questions. So my first question regards the actions of the appeals court. Ultimately, they could find you not guilty. But if they found you guilty, would they then stick with the 3.7 billion initial fine, or is there like a range of possibilities here where they could, you know, stick with the so-called tax revenues associated with the regularized assets? And then my second question is with regards to those tax revenues. I think you said it was 620 million relating to the 3.7 billion of regularized assets. It seems quite low. And I just wanted you to shed some color on that figure. Is that a figure that you've put forward or something that they agree with? Is there any shift in that figure?
Thanks. It's on page 188 of the judgment, and it's what the judge herself writes, that 620, 480, 477 euros.
Yeah, this is, first question, the Court of Appeals can, as you said, find us guilty or innocent. If they find the bank guilty, they have complete liberty to fix the fine at the level which they deem appropriate. There is absolutely no guidance or no obligation to follow, of course, the first instance decision. They can do whatever they want. The amount of unpaid taxes is derived from the information supplied by the tax authorities. It is relatively low because, you know, you have to realize that these people regularize themselves within the framework of regularization units where they've negotiated with the tax authorities, and that's the result of their deal they got from the tax authorities.
Understood. Thank you very much.
The next question comes from Ala Levitsakos, HSBC. Please go ahead, sir.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much for organizing this call. Very helpful. So my first question is basically just trying to understand, were you generally surprised by the outcome? I'm just trying to understand how, if you, during the process, you kind of got the feeling that this is not going the direction that you wanted to know. And then secondly, on appeals again, when is the last stage that you can actually not do anything and you just have to pay the amount that you're going to be told in France? And my third question, actually, it's about, you mentioned some territorial issues with French law being applied in Switzerland. What is the Swiss government's view on this decision as well? Do you have any feedback as of now? Thanks.
Clearly, we didn't expect the outcome, and none of the hearings gave us indication, again, they lasted for 6 weeks, that it would go in that direction. One is always smarter with the benefit of hindsight, and there's commentary on, you know, the environment in France, etc., but from a purely legal perspective, it could not have been expected.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, nothing specific took place during the hearings. The prosecutors were very reserved. They weren't very aggressive. The court, you know, questioned the various defendants in a normal fashion. There were no witnesses for the prosecution. The defense filed a very substantial defense. Clearly this was not expected. Second question is when should we be expected to pay anything if we're found guilty? That would be after the final decision in the process. So if the Supreme Court decides that, it would be after the decision by the Supreme Court immediately, or if the Supreme Court overturns the Court of Appeals decision, after another Court of Appeals has ruled on the matter. So it's a long time from now.
The last question comes from Andrew O'Flaherty from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead, sir.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. Can we just confirm that as long as the process remains unresolved, that we can assume that there will be no additional costs that you would take apart from your general legal costs to be paid by UBS, or anything in the same way that you took the 1.1 billion or had to reserve that in the past? Thank you.
That is correct.
Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was the last question. I would now like to turn the conference back over to Martin Osinga.
Yep. Thank you, Miruna. We have no further comments, and we can close the call. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, the conference is now over. Thank you for choosing Chorus Call, and thank you for participating in the conference. You may now disconnect your lines. Goodbye.